Hello, everyone. I'm Rania Kallik, and this is Dispatches. Iran's protests have been more widespread and more enduring than previous waves. The Iranian government seems uncertain about how to deal with the phenomenon, absorb it, contain it, offer reforms, or crush the protests. From the outside, it's impossible to know what's really going on. Iran seems like a deeply divided society. It's clear that these protests are more social than political. It appears that there's a genuine anger at the clergy. Although the regime change sharks outside can smell blood and are circling hungrily, it's also clear that the government or system are not threatened with collapse or revolution. Unlike protesters in the past in places like Ukraine, Syria, or Libya, there doesn't appear to be a desire on the part of this leaderless movement for an external intervention. Iranian nationalism seems to preclude that. We can't reduce what's happening to a CIA-backed color revolution. However, there are also acts of armed violence. And there's no doubt that Iran's enemies will take advantage of any sign of weakness, as they do in all countries deemed rogue. To better understand what's going on and what we can expect, I'm joined by Mohammad Mirandi, professor of English literature and Orientalism at the University of Tehran. But before we jump into it, if you appreciate this show, you can help it grow by becoming a patron at patreon.com/breakthroughnews. Mohammad, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much for having me, Rania.
Well, it's always such a pleasure to have you on, especially to break down these very like complex issues. And of course, right now, Iran has been in the news for the last month and a half or so because of these protests. So let's just jump right into it. You know, am I right in describing these protests as longer in duration and perhaps more geographically widespread than past ones? And if so, why is that?
Well, I would say it's more complicated. The protests, the peaceful protests, were in different cities during the first 2-3 days. And that was because news broke out from the Persian media in London and in Western countries in general, and online media and trolls and so on, that a young woman, Mahsa, she was beaten to death. And they also said that she was imprisoned for 3 days and she was tortured. And that created a lot of anger, obviously. I myself thought it was probably true at the beginning because they were so... they were presenting it in such a convincing manner, as if it's a fact, as if it's an established fact that she was beaten and tortured to death. I thought probably there was police brutality involved. Then the footage, like 3 days later, 2 days later, I'm not quite sure when, the footage came out showing that she left a police van. She was not handcuffed. She was not showing any signs of physical pain or holding her head. Then she was taken to a hall or a place where other people were sitting. She sat for a while. She moved around. Then she stood up and spoke with someone. And after that, she collapsed. Mm-hmm. The autopsy, which was comprised of, I think, 19 physicians, some of them very well known, did not indicate any sort of physical trauma or any physical object hitting her in the head. And it was said that this was linked to an operation that she had as a child. Now, her father, for whatever reason, some say he was under pressure because he lives in a Kurdish area close to the Iraqi border where we have Western Kurdish terrorist groups based. Maybe he was pressured by them. Her father said there was no operation. She had never even caught a cold in her life. But it did come out that she had an operation. And then after her father kept denying this, I think the government, they finally, after a week, They didn't want to show this clip, but after a week, they felt they had to. They showed a clip of him by her body. Officials were saying, you know, touch her head, touch, look at wherever you want. And he was saying, no, no, it's obvious that, you know, there's no physical trauma, if I'm saying the word correctly. There's no sign of her being beaten or anything. And then he himself spoke about her operation as a child. So a lot of the protests died down during this period when this information was coming out. Of course, it didn't come out all at the same time. But in any case, the protests died down. Then we had a rise of riots and violence. And I wouldn't call those protests, because when we speak about protests, we're usually thinking about like people on the streets chanting slogans and then dispersing, going home. Mm-hmm. These were rioters. They attacked public buildings. They attacked people. Over the last 6-7 weeks, I think almost 50 police officers or Basij people were killed. Of course, most of them in near the Iraqi border in the Kurdish areas, and in Sistan Baluchistan, near where you have terrorist groups that operate in the no man's land in Pakistan, Western backed and Saudi backed, and of course in Iraqi Kurdistan, they're also NATO backed and backed by more than one government in the Persian Gulf region, the Saudis, but it's not just the Saudis. But I'll refrain from giving names now for obvious reasons. But many were killed in the different cities. So these were not just protests. These were not protests. These were very violent riots. And groups of thugs would come out on the street, and they were very well organized. So you would have simultaneously, like let's say in Tehran, of course it's died down over the past 2-3 weeks. We really haven't seen anything. Yesterday, they tried to revive these riots, but they failed more or less. But over the past 2-3 weeks, nothing really was going on. It's been quiet. It's been more or less normal. But during the height of the riots, you'd have suddenly groups of 5, 10, 15 people, sometimes 20, suddenly go to different parts of Tehran and try to create chaos. And then in some instances, you'd have ordinary people join them. They'd become 20, 30, 40, but they were all simultaneous.
Yeah.
And it was obvious that they were centrally coordinated and funded from abroad. Now, those who in the West who say, no, there's nothing coming from abroad, obviously they're either being naive or dishonest. But in any case, the Western-funded groups like the Mujahideen Khalq terrorist organization, which I'm sure you know, has bases across Europe. It has a huge military camp or military base in Albania.
Mm-hmm.
Where thousands of their the followers of this cult are stationed there. And they have a huge troll farm and where they work 24 hours a day. But and also those who defect go to jail. Like people, they defect from the MEK in Albania.
Yeah, it's a cult. I mean, it's a cult. It's more than just, I mean, it's a terrorist organization, but it's also an actual cult. Like it is, there's lots of, and people can go read about it. It's actually quite shocking. And the US and I believe the Saudis like fully support it and support that base in Albania, but an actual cult.
Well, the whole
cult,
NATO does, because NATO is Albania is a NATO country.
Right,
and the Albanian government arrests people who defect.
That's crazy.
From the cult.
That's crazy.
So the MEK, which in the 1980s, they killed 17,000 Iranians through suicide bombings, ordinary bombings, assassinations, and knifing people. I'm on the main campus of the University of Tehran near here. We would have bomb explosions. One morning when I was a school student, I was getting ready to go to school. Then suddenly all of our windows were shattered and a bomb exploded near our house, killing, I think, 9 or 11 people. I always get confused. I looked this up a couple of times and then I still forget. I don't know why, but I think there was an Armenian family of four also that were among the killed, those who were martyred in that particular attack. I lived back then in a mixed neighborhood where there were lots of Armenians. So the MEK then went to Iraq. They went to Europe. They established bases in Europe in the 1980s, and they also went to Iraq and fought as foot soldiers for Saddam Hussein against their own country. Yep. They openly claim that they're involved in the riots in Tehran, which is a fact. The Iranian intelligence have established this. They know it's clear as day that the links, many have been arrested, but they themselves make the claim. Or the monarchists, also Western funded, they claim to be involved in the riots. The Kurdish terrorist groups based in northern Iraq, they have bases there. They are trained there. They claim to be involved in the riots across Iran. Mm-hmm. So it's not as if Iran is making accusations and then they're making these claims and saying, you know, we're doing it, we're behind it. And then in addition to that, and this is what I find so extraordinary, and Western media won't say anything about it, even though I know many, many legacy media journalists follow me. I know that. I know who they are. At least I know quite a few of them. In my Twitter account, I've been pointing out where, in some cases, I don't do it all day, but where the Persian media based in London and in the United States and elsewhere, and in Germany and France, but mostly in London, BBC Persian, Iran International, which is a Saudi outlet, Manoto, media outlets like these have been legitimizing violence against police, saying, and I put up a clip, or at least one or two clips, where they say, one of them actually says, you can burn them alive, you can beat them, and you can murder them. It's legitimate. Ooh. If you do so, it's legitimate.
This is happening, you're saying, in like Western-funded Persian media specifically. You're talking about like Persian.
Based in London. In London. So they're constantly, you know, calling, you know, they're basically calling people to go to the streets. They're
inciting, incitement of violence. I mean, they're inciting violence and unrest, essentially. Violence. Yeah.
And even like in one case that I saw, they were saying, you know, burning them alive is justified. And that is what they've done. Just yesterday, a police officer was murdered by thugs. A person who was policing the streets in Shiraz was murdered by thugs by firebombing. They threw a firebomb at him and hit him in the head and he died. But that's okay for, you know, Trudeau, Justin Trudeau, who tweets and lies about 15,000 people being executed. He will not apologize for it. He tweeted both in French and in English because he himself is, you know, he is involved in the genocide in Yemen. So I don't even want to go there.
Just for some background for those who weren't following, what you're referring to is that for the last 4 or 5 days, there's been this claim that went viral, which turns out to be completely fake, that Iran sentenced 15,000 protesters to execution. And this claim, I believe, came from like some US funded group. And the media, I think Newsweek was the first one, but the US, like Western press, ran with it. And then the last few days, there was just all these celebrities tweeting out in support of these 15,000 protesters that were going to be executed. Then Justin Trudeau also tweeted out a condemnation. And within 12 hours, he actually had to remove the tweet because this was such an outrageous lie that even Instagram was putting a label on it, on posts that were claiming it, saying this is not true, this is misinformation, and covering it. And even CNN, who I believe at first had supported this claim, went back and said, oh yeah, this was a fake, this is like fake news. And it just goes to show you how you can literally, in Western media, and we know this, But it's like when it happens, it's kind of shocking. You can make any claim or these sort of Saudi funded National Endowment for Democracy, you know, US funded, quote unquote, human rights groups can literally make any claim they want to about Iran. And the US media will run with it until it's proven untrue. And in this case, it was just so ridiculous because like 15,000 protesters sentenced to like this never happened. Like it was literally made up, completely fabricated. You're smiling. Go ahead. I'm sure you want to.
And they even said that Iranian parliament decided. As in, what does the parliament have to do with the judiciary?
Yeah.
So, I mean, when it comes to Iran, anything goes. And that's why so many people in the left in the United States will hop on the bandwagon when it comes to Iran. If it's North Korea or Saddam Hussein,
anything you want to.
Gas so many people with Western help and support and assistance. If it's any other country, it wouldn't be believed so in such a widespread manner as in Western countries, because the demonization of Iran, in my opinion, is unique. Russians are not as evil as we are. So this is not the first time you have like these. There was a memoir written by Azar Nafisi, full of garbage, and it was a bestseller in the United States for a very long time, called Reading Lolita in Tehran, which is somewhat ironic, Lolita, and I think about the Lolita Express and Bill Clinton, but yeah, anyway. So in that, one of the many lies that she pushed was that she said that when they take prisoners, the guards or the Revolutionary Guards or whoever, female prisoners who are virgins, they rape them before they execute them, because if they die virgins, they go to heaven. This is like, and it's based upon like their ideology or their religion, something, you know. You think, well, if they're religious people, it would be
the opposite.
But the thing is that these outrageous lies are so easily believed in the United States and the West. Why? Because they say, well, yes, this is expected. And it's promoted by publishing companies, think tankers, because Azar Nafisi was a big thing. I mean, she was very influential. And then before that, we also had like that Not Without My Daughter and, all sorts of...
Oh, right, yeah. I actually, that was like a little before my time, but I saw the preview for that and I was like, what is this trash? Jesus.
Or Paris Police, which is like, and then they made a cartoon out of it, or a cartoon film, if that's what it's called. Yes, it's like a huge business. And then one of the other claims that is often made, and I was actually in an airport once and I went into a bookshop, and it was into the history part of the bookshop. And I opened a history book, and I happened to open up a page on Iran, mm-hmm. and it was talking about these young Iranian soldiers who they would be given keys to heaven. So, like, if they died on the battlefield and they had these plastic keys around their neck, they'd go to heaven. This was widespread in the West. And as I said, you even saw them in history books. And then once I wrote an article about this to a very famous academic journal in the United States about Azar Nafisi and other writers who wrote a lot of nonsense. And the referees, they were peer reviewed, and the reviewers, one of them at least, said that I have to prove that those keys to heaven didn't exist. I critiqued her. And they didn't publish my work. They said, we can't publish because... So I had to effectively prove a negative, which is impossible.
Yeah.
Even though I was a veteran of that war, even though I was a part of that war from the age of 16, to the end of the war, the defense effort of the country against Saddam Hussein, I was gassed twice. There were no such keys anywhere, but I had to prove a negative. And then I told the editor of the journal, I sent her an email, and I said, if I wrote an article and said American soldiers in Iraq had keys to heaven, it wouldn't be published, because you'd say it's obviously nonsense.
Right.
Why? Because American soldiers are probably informed people and sane people. But if someone says keys, Iranians have keys to heaven, if I say that's not the case, I'm not given space.
Right.
Because I have to prove that there are
it's completely ridiculous, like the standards that a country like Iran is held to, but it's for obvious reasons, right? It's to create this or to prime people to believe the worst. But I do want to ask you to elaborate on something here, if you can. And that is, sure. You know, obviously sometimes a small spark can unpredictably ignite a big social movement. But of course, like, we can't be naive when it comes to Iran. There's a lot of potential for foreign interference taking place. In some cases, we know there is. How important is the foreign role here compared to just normal social grievances? And by foreign role, like, I include, of course, like Western and Saudi funded media, as well as the sort of regional and Western covert operations that we know take place in Iran on a regular basis.
Well, there are grievances, but even, I mean, there are significant grievances. The economy is not doing well at all. I mean, it's sort of like where you are. It's not like in Lebanon, but where you are in Lebanon, the United States is strangling the country. And then people say, well, why can't the government why are things so bad in the country? The Lebanese must be terrible administrators.
Right.
Well, you know, sort of like, you know, me trying to strangle you and say, well, why don't you just breathe? Well, if you just take your hand off the person's throat, maybe they would breathe. So on the one hand, you have these, you know, this maximum pressure sanctions imposed on Iran, where everything is sanctioned. Whenever you hear the Europeans and the Americans impose new sanctions, it's basically meaningless because everything is already sanctioned. So if they sanction me twice already and then they sanction me again, it's not going to do anything. It's just out of like desperation. They don't know what to do. So they say, okay, let's sanction him in a different manner.
Right.
So they impose maximum pressure to create suffering so that people die, so that people lose jobs, so that people can't purchase food and medicine, so that their lives become as miserable as possible.
Right.
Then, as you pointed out, they have this huge media apparatus. But it's not just the Persian media. And as I said, if this media said the sort of things that I explained to you earlier, they, day and night, if they'd been saying it in English for an English-speaking audience, Ofcom would shut it down immediately and these people would be put on trial. But in any case, it's Iran, so it's all good. But there's this huge media apparatus, and it's not just these major media outlets that are heavily funded by Saudi Arabia and Western governments. But it's also other media outlets that are funded, which actually tell people how to make Molotov cocktails and, you know, how to attack the police. And then you have online, you have bots and trolls, you know, huge numbers. If the whole population of China and India were to sit down day and night and tweet against Iran, they couldn't get these amount of tweets out there. So, and then you have, and then there are big accounts which train people how to assault the police, how to, and if no matter how many people complain to Twitter or Instagram or Facebook, they are not touched. They continue doing what they have to do. But we have to be careful about what we say. I mean, I lost my Facebook account because I put up a picture of a person who was a commander of mine who was ill because of the chemical weapons used against him. And they took down my Facebook account. My Instagram account, I don't even know why they took it down. And they never explained. They just took it away from me.
Wow.
And I decided not to make new accounts. So I just have a Twitter account now. But the point is that they can say what they want, but people who are critical have to be very careful about what pictures they post and what they say. So you have this. So you have this huge apparatus carrying out psychological warfare against them, putting out misinformation, playing on ethnic tensions, playing on ethnicity on TV, on these Iran International, BBC Persian, playing one ethnic group against another, trying to create divisions, sectarian divisions. That's what they're doing all the time. Again, if this was in English, it would not be tolerated for a minute. Not right. a single minute. It would be finished today. But so you have all this. Then you have grievances. But as I said, it's very difficult to separate grievances from, you know, when I'm strangling you and you can't breathe. How can you give a score or a grade to an administration when its hands are bound or its legs are bound? But those grievances, for whatever reason, they do exist. They are significant. And in my opinion, the protest during the first 2-3 days and some of the people who joined the riots during the subsequent 3-4 weeks before they died down, I would say that those ordinary people who joined probably, although I don't have any scientific proof for this, but I have anecdotal evidence to back this claim up, is because of economic hardship, mm-hmm. because of a sense of despair.
Which is what the sanctions are intended to do, right? They're intended to cause that economic hardship, to cause grievances, so that people during a time of social implosion or unrest will have grievances to go out and express and join to, you know, hopefully in the U.S. I mean, that's literally what the U.S. says is the intention of sanctions. Like, we know this for a fact. Yeah.
Absolutely.
So you mentioned that some of these media outlets are essentially provoking ethnic and sectarian tensions. And so far, the armed attacks and acts of insurgency do appear to be largely done by Kurds. Am I right that this is the PKK? And are there separatist elements here?
Police officers and besieged people have been killed across the country. So in the north of Iran, in the south, the middle of Iran, central Iran, it's happened across the whole of the country. But I would say, proportionally speaking, yes, there are a more worrying Kurdish areas. And in Baluchistan, near the Pakistani border. Because we have to keep in mind that Pakistan is a very poor country, thanks to the United States. Because when the Soviet Union, when the Americans began to help the extremists or the militants in Afghanistan to encourage the Soviet Union to invade, I mean, that's what Brzezinski admitted. He said, we actually did the funding before the Soviets entered because we wanted the Soviet Union to invade Afghanistan. And he and Carter agreed with that. So after the Soviets invaded and the Americans established, and the British and others established, and the Saudis established themselves in Pakistan, things in Pakistan began to deteriorate as well. You had a huge influx of refugees, and then you had the rise of the extremists that the Americans and the Saudis and the Europeans and the British were supporting. So Pakistan 40, 50 years ago, Afghanistan 40, 50 years ago, was actually, they were both actually pretty good places. I mean, it was not like what it is now at all. So Pakistan is a very poor country and has very little infrastructure. So the border with Iran is not really protected. The Pakistani army presence and intelligence presence is very minimal and non-existent in many areas. So the Americans and the Saudis, they fund Wahhabi groups that are based in Pakistan. So they come into Iran, carry out attacks, and then they flee back into Pakistan. So some of that exists well. The PKK is not directly involved, but the propaganda campaign across Europe, they are involved.
Okay.
The propaganda campaign against Iran. But you have the Komale, you have the Democrats, the Democrat group. There are different terrorist organizations in northern Iraq. That, as I said, they have tens of bases there. And since the central government in Iraq is not strong, and since the Americans have huge influence over Erbil and Barzani, Barzani is forced to obey the Americans. He's not really an independent actor. He's only right. in power because the Americans keep him there. So the Americans want these terrorist groups in different cities, different towns, different areas in northern Iraq, and they carry out attacks and terrorist attacks in Iran through these bases. But as I said earlier, the killings take place across the country, the killings of police officers and Basij and so on.
And how has the government responded to the protests so far?
Well, it depends on
where
how one looks at the whole thing. I mean, if there was no foreign interference, I don't believe anyone would have been killed on any side. I think you would probably have had very small protests during the first couple of days. I mean, if there was no Persian media in Europe, you probably wouldn't have had protests. People would have waited to see what the news said and so on. It would probably, nothing would have happened.
Right.
We probably wouldn't have had, nothing would have happened in the first place, probably. So foreign interference had all levels, whether supporting violence, supporting terrorists, propaganda, warfare, maximum pressure on the ordinary population, putting that, you know, all that combined created this situation. Without that, we wouldn't have had any of this. Iran, I would say with great confidence, is more open society than any other country in West Asia. Any other country in West Asia. Turkey, Turkey and Iran, they have different types of issues. Mm-hmm. So I don't want to directly compare the two.
Right.
But the things that are said in Iran or done in Iran, if it was in Turkey, after the coup, hundreds of thousands of people lost their jobs in Turkey. Academics, school teachers, schools were shut down. That hasn't happened in Iran. Even though the foreign pressure in Iran is incomparable, it's far greater than anywhere else.
Than Turkey.
So, and also the public legitimacy of the Islamic Republic, all you have to do is just go back to the murder of General Soleimani.
Yeah.
I mean, they were saying how hated he was in Iraq. And how unpopular the Islamic Republic was. When he was murdered in Iraq, we saw the funeral ceremonies where hundreds of thousands of people in each of the different Iraqi cities participated in the funeral. And then in Iran, a much larger country, we saw millions. And in Tehran, it was just, I don't know, it was unprecedented, I think. I don't think there was ever such a gathering anywhere in the world. But so... the public legitimacy, I mean, he was the symbol of the Islamic Republic of Iran. He was a martyr of the Islamic Republic of Iran. So the public legitimacy, the general public legitimacy of the Islamic Republic, I think there's no doubt about it. But the problem is that in the West, they create their own narratives. They believe their own narratives. They listen to these so-called Iranian groups that say what needs to be heard. If someone really says anything that runs against the narrative, they'll lose their status in Western society. I mean, people like Flint and Hilary Leverett, who wrote a very good book, Going to Tehran, both worked in the White House.
Right.
Both were high-ranking officials. They were, you know, I think Hilary Leverett probably doesn't have a job. Flint Leverett is teaching in some university at Penn State that's like 500 miles from where they live or something like that.
Yeah.
From what I've heard. And you'll be punished. So, yeah, the narrative is so powerful that anything, as I said, as we were discussing earlier, anything that negative about Iran is accepted. And therefore, if you say something that is runs counter to that, your mouthpiece, you support evil, But the question for me is, okay, if what we're saying is wrong, if we're lying in Europe, if what you're saying is based on fact, and the so-called regime, as they like to call it, is collapsing, then, I mean, it's so hated and people hate it so much, then why is it simultaneously both collapsing but also a rising threat? How can it be both at the same time?
It kind of reminds me of how they talk about Russia, actually, where they're like, oh, like Putin and is both losing in Ukraine, but he also poses a threat to every other country and could possibly invade it. It's like, which is it?
Russia is a declining power, but the whole of Europe should be terrified that he's going to invade it.
And they do that. They do that with every, it's like, yeah, you're right. Iran is both collapsing and there's a huge revolution, but then it's also like, Iran at any moment could literally just like destroy the world. And it's, well, which is it? It can't be both. But you know, it's interesting because speaking of like narratives, when widespread
and also
protests,
I'm sorry for interrupting.
No.
There is no accountability. These people have been saying this for like 40 years.
Yeah.
Go back 5 years, 10 years, 15 years. There's always a revolution. People hate if the younger generation. It's always the younger generation. 20 years ago was the younger generation that wanted something different. 10 years ago was the younger. But there's no accountability.
Right.
So when they say that, okay, it's going to collapse. So they were saying it 20 years ago. The same people are just repeating themselves. Zero accountability. No one is going to say, well, look, so-and-so, your predictions have been wrong for the last 20 years. So we're going to kick you out of the think tank. We're going to kick you out.
It
doesn't work that way. You just repeat the same things over and over again. But if someone actually says something that turns out to be correct, they say, look, it's not going to fall. I was once on Farid Zakaria's show on CNN. He was really abusive to me. And he promised to show the whole, his people promised me in writing to show the whole thing. And they, out of 20 minutes, they only showed 8 minutes. So, but in any case, they said it in writing, just as recently I had a program with Mrs. Amanpour, and they also told me it would be shown in full, but they deleted parts. Not as much as Zakaria's people did, but in any case. In that interview, Zakaria, 13 years ago, said to me, I think he said something like, you're the mouthpiece of a dying regime. It's been 13 years. It's a long death. I mean, 13 years
say,
now.
You could say that about Farid Zakaria, by the way. I wanted to, though, note that, like, when, you know, because some people have trouble viewing it like this, but when widespread protests take place in the West, right, or allies of the West, whether it's like Black Lives Matter or protests against the former right-wing government in Colombia, for example, they don't get covered as though they're a revolution, but just protests, right, against a grievance that might lead to some, you know, perhaps legal reforms or changes in the next elections. But like when protests take place in countries targeted by the West for regime change, then they're embraced and supported and everybody predicts revolution. And to question any narrative makes you, like you said, a mouthpiece for a regime. In your view, can we compare the current wave in Iran to be like the summer of 2020 in the US, where this one act of injustice by police sparked all this legitimate anger that manifested itself in protests and also in some cases riots and violence, but though nowhere near what's happened in Iran, but eventually it died down after symbolic changes? Or is this different? I mean, in other words, like, how do you expect the situation to be resolved?
Well, I would say it's very different. First of all, because of foreign influence, and also because of the huge psychological warfare that is being carried out, people are fearful. Students, for example, during the weeks when classes were closed, well, they weren't closed, but many students wouldn't show up. Students were scared because the media, this Persian media, was constantly speaking as if the country was like some sort of civil war. I just walk around campus. I go, you know, this is the main campus. Nothing happens. I go shopping, I go out. I haven't seen anything myself, but when people are looking online or watching the media, they think like, you know, it's immensely dangerous. So a lot of the students would be afraid. These people, these groups would intimidate students. They'd say, after we overthrow the regime, we're going to deal with you.
Oh, geez.
We've had professors in my faculty. We had a large faculty meeting a month ago. as I said, it's all died down now, basically. But about, today, yesterday, they tried to reemerge, to recreate what was going on a few weeks ago, but they largely failed. But at the height of the riots, we had a faculty meeting in my own faculty, the Faculty of Foreign Languages and Literature. And it was interesting. Four professors spoke about intimidation mm-hmm. in a meeting. There were others. I mean, I've had many death threats during this period, many death threats and all sorts of threats. My family, I don't want to go there. But I didn't say anything about these things in the meeting, but four people spoke about intimidation. One was a male professor, three were women professors. So this was supposedly all about women. But one of the three women said that she was threatened sexually.
Wow.
Yes, one of the women, her class was attacked as she was teaching. And one of the women was actually the dean of my faculty, who was intimidated by this gang of, small gang of students. Harass and fake news was spread about her, and her every move was sent to Iran International, the Saudi TV channel, Mohammed bin Salman, the great promoter of women's rights and human rights. Some girl would go up to her and say, "So you're saying I'm a dog?" And then they'd record that, and then they'd send it, and they'd show it on Iran International as if she said, like, she's a dog, and she was responding, like the dean said that she's a dog, and that she's responding to what the dean said. You know what I mean? The dean didn't say anything. She'd just say something, they'd record it and send it to Iran International.
That's tricky. So, yeah.
Yeah, exactly. And she's the dean. So my boss, I mean, in the West, women, apparently Iranian women have no role to play. My boss at the University of Tehran is a woman, the dean of I've been at the University of Tehran for 20 years. In these 20 years, 15 or 16 of those years, the dean of my faculty were women. Of course, most of the, I don't want to mislead your viewers, most of those people who run the University of Tehran are men. Most of the deans of faculties are men. But my faculty happened to be, since I was a part of this faculty, an academic, for the 20 years that I, in a couple of months, it'll be 20 years that I've been at the University of Tehran, a couple of months. I would say 15 or 16 of the years, I don't know exactly, the dean of the faculty was a woman. So, but in any case, that's a footnote. So what was the question? Yeah, so
how do you think it's going to be resolved?
I would say that this is not Black Lives Matter or January the 6th, because they had no foreign influence. I mean, when Trump was elected, the whole story was that the Russians brought him to power. Well, let's look at it from two different ways. If the Russians brought him to power, they either did it or they didn't do it. If they did it, well, that's exactly what the Americans tried to do everywhere else. So what's wrong with that? Second of all, there's no real evidence that the Russians did anything. And if they did, it wasn't really significant. I mean, what could the Russians do that compared to the whole media campaign and the apparatus inside the United States during the elections?
Right.
The dirty tactics used by both the Democrats and the Republicans against one another. So, but in Iran, it's not just the United States, it's the whole of the EU, Canada, the United States, Australia, New Zealand, all of these countries, very white countries, but in any case, they all, and their embassies in Iran have all been active, the French embassy, the German embassy, during the last couple of months in Tehran, as I said, things have died down now, but they've been very active. There are people meeting students who are part of these groups in coffee shops and it's extraordinary how what they do.
And I mean, you remember, you could imagine the reaction if it was the other way around. If the Iranian embassy in Western countries was like meeting with activists, how that would be.
But do you remember during the 2020 elections in the United States, they came out in the United States and said two Iranians. Two Iranians sent emails into people in Alaska threatening them to vote for Trump.
Oh yeah. I remember that. Yeah.
And they were charged. They don't need evidence. They don't need to prove it to them. You can charge two Iranians allegedly sent emails trying to influence, like how many emails did they send? Did they send them to Alaska? You know, like how Alaska plays, as you know, plays a central role in deciding who's going to be the future president of the United States. So they are punished and charged because of they sent emails, threatening emails that, you know, say that people should vote for Trump for whatever reason. But they can have all these TV channels. They can have all these terrorist organizations. They can have all these NGOs. They can fund all these groups who, even in Europe and the United States, even in Europe, there are protests against Iran are violent. They go to the Iranian embassy and they attack the police. They attack ordinary people on the street. They attack people who are going to the mosque, or local mosque, who aren't even Iranian. That's the people who the Americans and the Europeans are funding.
Well, let me ask you, you know, just to go back to one of the original issues of all of this before it was like overtaken by regime change narratives. In the immediate aftermath of the Iranian Revolution, there was, as far as I understand, no hijab requirement. So when did the government impose it and why?
Okay, that's, you know, I was, when the revolution happened, I was 13. So... Mm-hmm. This is based on my readings, not so much
Fair
on
enough.
My now.
Good caveat.
But,
okay.
I mean, I'm much older than you, but still, that's a long time ago for me too. Actually, I don't know exactly when the hijab law was put in place, but first let me explain something and then I'll talk about the interesting hijab law. In Iranian culture and society and religion, the notion of female commodification, sexualization and objectification is different than in the West. So, you know, for them, those who believe in the hijab or believe that women and men must dress modestly, what their argument is not that they're limiting women, they see it as preventing women from being objectified and sexualized and commodified and so on. So that aside, the interesting thing is that those people who are now outside of Iran, and many of them are openly working against the country, many of them were the people who actually, they were the ones who established this law.
Really?
Many of the liberals, yes, in the 1980s and the early 1990s, the so-called hardliners in Iran were the reformists. I won't name names. People can look it up themselves. I don't like going there because I try not to get involved in Iranian politics. In 2015, Dr. Zarif asked me to be a part of his negotiating team. I said I won't. He wanted me to be a negotiator. I said no. He wanted me to be the spokesman for the team. I said no. But then I agreed to be sort of like an advisor for international media. Mm. I joined him. And when Dr. Bogri went to Vienna, and you interviewed me when I was in Vienna, I accepted the same role. So my role, I helped both Dr. Bogri from this administration, Dr. Zay from the previous administration, both at the same capacity as media advisor, basically international media, not Iranian media. So many people in Iran actually think I'm the negotiator or I'm the guy in charge or something. I didn't even go and sit at the negotiating table. I said I'm staying clear of that both and on both occasions. But the point is I don't want to get involved in Iranian internal politics. So, but the thing is that the people actually set up the law that made the hijab compulsory were back then the people who are now the reformists. And many of them are just secular, many of them are liberal, but they set up that law, the key people behind it. Then after the reformists were removed from power in the 1990s, the implementation of the law became more lax. And even now, I mean, during the last few years, it's become completely relaxed. Before this whole, this whole situation that we've had, women in parts of, I was on it. I was doing an interview on the BBC. You know how the BBC works. They told me we're going to interview you. And then when it started, they brought in a lady during the interview. They said, if it's okay, we're going to have her ask questions. Like I said, I don't, it's fine with me. And then in any case, I explained that many people, especially in the northern part of Tehran, weren't wearing the hijab. And then she had to find a sort of respond to me and say, well, yes, this is a class thing. The rich can do whatever they want, but it's the poor, which is not the case. In southern Tehran and in central Tehran, people are more religious. The wealthy are more secular. It's not just in Iran.
That's pretty much a universal, typically. I mean, yeah, you could say the same thing absolutely. About a lot of parts of the U.S. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. So she, instead of acknowledging this fact, because she used the fact, she tried to put Iran in a negative light, a different way. Say, oh, yes, that's because like the rich in Iran. Whereas the supporters of the Islamic Republic are basically the middle and lower middle class. It's like the 60-70% of the, I mean, I'm not saying all, no one who's wealthy or no one who, I mean, those, but like we're wealthy, they're opposed, not that everyone's opposed, but, and that, or that all the, let's say, lower, those people who are more vulnerable, let's say, economically, that they're all supportive. But in general, those classes are more supportive and those classes are less supportive, let's say. But the point that she was trying to manipulate what I said in a very dishonest manner, I won't mention her name, but as I said, but the point is that the law has not been enforced right. for quite a while now, or at least seriously enforced. There were cases, like in the case of this young lady. I don't know how she was dressed. I'm not even sure if it was about the headscarf or just her dress. I don't know. But the point is that it was obvious that she was not beat. That is pretty clear cut. And even now the West, they won't claim it directly. So they'll say she died in custody.
Right,
because it implies that, but they won't say it. And let me give an interesting example, because the poor young woman Mahsa reminds me of some other instance where I was saying earlier how they use sectarian ethnic divisions. Azeri people in Iran are as Iranian as anyone else. I mean, they are. I mean, the leader, Ayatollah Khamenei. Khamenei means from Khamenei. Khamenei is a Turkish city. The leader is very fluent in Turkish, right? Many of the Iranian leaders, they're Turkish. And they're Shia, of course. So what Iran International, the Saudi channel, and the BBC Persian and the others tried to do, because they keep killing these Persian media outlets. They keep killing young girls. And if a girl commits suicide or falls from a chair or dies of cancer, they'll find some young girl and then say, oh, she was killed by the regime. I don't know if you've seen, like, during the past few days, they show a picture of a young girl. It's always young girls, not these young guys. Or not old women. If some girl dies of cancer, or if she's murdered by someone, or she dies of an overdose of drugs, if she's good-looking enough for these people, they'll you know, put up her name and call her a martyr, you know, or murdered by the police. They have these fake stories. One of those fake stories was because the Azerbaijan provinces in Iran have been the quietest. There have been fewer riots than anywhere else. So they cooked up a story. I don't know if you remember this. I tweeted this, saying that this young girl in Ardabil, which is a Turkish city, the police attacked the school and then she was beaten. Long story short, she was beaten and she died. Mm-hmm. Then it turns out, and then The Guardian and all the Western media outlets mimicked the Iran International, BBC Persian. Why did they do this? Because they wanted to create a Turkish divide, which is impossible. I mean, I'm Marandi. My ancestors are from Maran. It's a Turkish city. I mean, it's just impossible. The Republic of Azerbaijan is the regime there, or the government there, the president there, is scared of Iran because he's more scared of Iranian influence in his country than the Iranians are of his influence, even though he has Israeli support and so on. So it turns out that this girl that died, she died of a family tragedy. The government never said the real reason, what the nature of that family tragedy was, out of respect for the family, although I know what happened. But the girl wasn't even at that school. This girl never even went to that school. The girl had nothing to do with that school. They just made up the story. Some girl died for whatever reason. I once said the reason somewhere else, and then someone reminded me that this is, you know, you shouldn't say this. This is because this is a family matter. And you know, the Iranian government, out of respect for the family, they never said it. You will not hear it anywhere on Iranian television or anywhere, even though it's to their benefit to point out what exactly happened to that girl to prove their point that this is a lie, but they never did it out of respect for the family. But in any case, it was just a fake story altogether. But that was like one instance where they were trying to create this. So in the West, when they speak about, you know, liberalism and melting pots and multiculturalism, when it comes to Iran, they try to create sectarian fractures. They try to create ethnic fractures as much as possible. That's how hypocritical they are. If you want, we can go to the...
Yeah. No, I mean, I think that that's a really good point in the sense that that's what they do across the entire Middle East.
And as you rightly point out, this is not unique to Iran. They'll use religious and ethnic fractures, or they'll try to create them across the world. They've done that for decades, for centuries. In the country where you reside, they do it all the time. So it's not unique to Iran, but it is significant. One thing that I would like to also add before you ask your next question, because I'm afraid I'll forget, is that when you have maybe yesterday three Basij members or police officers or people who are patrolling the streets or the guards, three people were killed in three areas of the country. Even though, as I said, the riots have died down, but these two of them were assassinated. And one was hit by a firebomb. In the United States and in Europe, if you had these numbers of police deaths, it's going to be very violent. They don't have these numbers. And then, you know, being encouraged to kill them and demonizing the police, dehumanizing them on these Persian media outlets, whether the troll farms or the television stations or websites and, you know, Telegram channels and all that. So yes, ordinary people on the streets may be caught up in the crossfire, in the fighting. Many of the rioters will be hurt, injured, and some killed, like the police officers. It's obvious that's going to happen. There's no doubt about it. But the way in which it is constructed in the West is as if this demonic power and these police officer or a bunch of, I don't know, orcs. And therefore, killing them is fine.
Yeah.
They don't have families. They don't have children. They don't have lives. So the way in which this whole thing is represented in the West is in a way in which the Western media is the Western population, I understand why they're so easily misled.
Well, I wanted to know, you know, to play devil's advocate here, is it possible that this older generation of founders of the Islamic Republic of Iran might be disconnected from youth and risk losing them if something isn't changed about the current laws that people are upset about?
Definitely. But this has always been a challenge. And as I was saying earlier, these so-called Iran experts have always been saying for the last 30 years that the previous generation supported the revolution. And then 20 years ago, the previous, 10 years ago, the previous generation. It's always the new generation. But the point is that, and of course, that argument is not made because they really believe it. It's because it's that narrative of the regime is illegitimate. And
right.
I think it's based upon a very racist worldview that no other structure of governance is legitimate except for that which exists in the West. So if there's an indigenous model or non-Western model where the constitution is different from that in the West, where the ideas and beliefs are not the same as in the West, it's a regime.
Yeah.
Because it's not normal, it's abnormal. And therefore it will inevitably collapse because it has no legitimacy. What I would argue, my counter argument would be that actually the fact that Iran has been able to grow stronger and become more influential and be able to continue functioning as a country despite all this antagonism, war through Saddam Hussein, chemical weapons, sanctions, supporting terrorists, supporting ISIS and al-Qaeda and all that, despite all that, the fact that Iran is able to continue to be powerful and increasingly powerful, despite the difficulties and the hardships that the Europeans and the Americans have imposed upon ordinary people in Iran, that shows that actually this structure is competent. I mean, imagine that if there were no sanctions, then right. What would Iran be able to do? So, but yes, it's always a challenge, especially since this Persian media is constantly day and night, you know, putting out misinformation. They distort history. When they make documentaries, they destroy or they create an alternative history that doesn't have much similarity to what really went on in Iran. They even try to now make the Shah as if he was a person who is developing the country and the Shah's father. So this revisionism that is supported by the West at all levels, even the Mujahideen Khalq, which in Iran we call them the Munafiqeen, the hypocrites, even, you know, now they're constantly on Western media outlets, English, but also in the Persian outlets. And they're trying to make them look as if they are more respectable now than they were, you know, than they were presented as before, even in these media outlets. That is always going to be a challenge. But I think that by the time this ends, this era, I'm not talking about Iran. I mean, the changes that are taking place in the world, Ukraine, NATO, the United States, the decline of the West. By the time this process ends and we have this shift, and I think many of the young people in Iran who are influenced by the West, who do think that somehow the West is some sort of utopia, because that's what BBC Persian, VOA Persian, Iran International, the Saudi TV outlet, and all these others are basically saying. They're saying you're miserable, but outside of Iran is some sort of, not just in the West, outside of Iran, anywhere is better than Iran. In the West, of course, is some sort of utopia. You don't see in BBC Persian any or Iran International, any of these outlets, the problems that now exist across Europe or the issues in the United States. It's presented as if all is fine there. But I think that people are going to see that, you know, people are going to see a lot more of the real world in, you know, I think in the coming months.
Yeah.
Despite media propaganda.
And then I wanted to ask you just to, you know, just a couple more things here. One is, obviously, the U.S. is always involved in trying to stoke unrest in Iran. But we know if it was the Trump administration or if it was like Pompeo or Kushner and their cohorts were still around, they would have seized upon this probably in a more serious way. Do you see a difference in the American response because of who's in office? And then just to jump off of that, are there still any talks for the JCPOA or is that just like done?
Okay, that's two things.
That's two questions, yeah.
I'll leave the JCPOA for later, and then first I'll explain. I don't see any difference.
Okay.
Actually, I think that Trump and Pompeo were so crude that the way in which they antagonized Iran made it obvious even to people who are ill-informed that something was wrong in the United States. Mm. Something was wrong with the behavior of the United States because they were so crude. And you know of the example when I was invited by the BBC of all media outlets, BBC World, to go to Beirut for a panel discussion. Mm. And I agreed, even though it was recorded and I don't trust the BBC with recordings. I was about to go, and then they called me and said, we have a problem. The State Department has told AUB that you're not allowed on campus, and if you do go to the AUB campus, the university will be heavily fined. So the BBC wanted to remove me from the formats, the panel discussion. I said, that's fine with me, but you can't do it at AUB then. Mm. And the BBC resisted, and I said, "Okay, I'm going to cause you trouble," and I did. Right. To, you know, I
remember this, yeah.
Asbar and Al Manar and Al Mayadeen and other outlets, and you know, I made it difficult for them. And then they changed the place, and then they asked me to come, but they never said anything about what the State Department did to them. But what I'm saying is that Trump and Pompeo are so crude that their actions against Iran, it's visible how nasty and evil they are in the eyes of the world, except for those hardliners who support them. People like Obama, people like Biden, they're presented to be more humane. They're not. I mean, Obama, the war in Yemen, it started under Obama. He allowed it to happen.
Right.
He supported the Saudis. The dirty war in Syria, let's not go there. You and I know all the talking points. You know, no, we don't want to. And I'm sure your viewers know it better than me, at least. But Obama, he's the person who actually initiated maximum pressure against Iran. Let's not forget that. It wasn't Trump. Trump criticized Obama for striking a deal and decreasing the pressure, the sanctions against Iran after the nuclear deal. He was saying you should have kept those sanctions in place. And so Obama was the person who targeted women and children and the vulnerable in Iran through those sanctions before. And Biden right now, since becoming president, he's been pursuing maximum pressure. He's been pursuing the exact same policies as Trump. So there's no real difference, but I would say that they are more sophisticated in the way in which they present themselves.
Yeah, that's a good point. And then the JCPOA talks, are those like completely on hold or falling apart? Yeah,
here is going to be partially speculation on my behalf. First, I have to point out that, as I said earlier on, I was only an international media advisor.
Right.
Contrary to what many people, even in Iran, think.
Right.
And I was only played that role in Vienna. So I don't have anything to do with with any negotiations in Tehran, obviously, when they're in Tehran.
Yeah.
So that aside, I should quickly point out, go over a couple of talking points. The Iranians didn't leave the deal. It was the Americans. Obama violated the deal. He violated all of his commitments from day one. Then Trump tore up the deal. The whole time Iran was in full compliance. But it's not Iran's fault. After Trump left, the Iranians continued to abide by his commitments. Then finally, the Iranians decided to decrease their commitments to put pressure on the United States, and then they ended their commitments to put pressure on the Americans and the Europeans to get serious. Yeah. Ultimately, the talks revived. And during the talks, Iran was able to get very good concessions. They basically forced the Americans to give them those concessions. Concessions in order to have the JCPOA, the 2015 nuclear deal, fully implemented. The problem was that there were so many loopholes and problems that the Americans were misusing the 2015 deal. That's why Obama was able to violate it from day one. The Iranian central bank could never function properly. Iran's trade with foreign countries was supposed to be normalized. Americans were supposed to facilitate it. But behind the scenes, Obama was telling banks, shipping companies, insurance companies that they had no right to work with Iran. European bankers told me this themselves. So the Iranians gained many concessions to make sure that the Americans couldn't cheat Iran again.
Right.
They built a structure to protect the inadequately protected JCPOA. Right. So these protections should have been put in place in 2015, but many people didn't think that the Americans would betray Iran, even though I thought they would. But yeah. But in any case, so that after at the end of the negotiations, there were only a few words left, important words, that the Americans wanted to keep vague, but the Iranians wanted them to be precise so that they wouldn't become loopholes for the Americans to use.
Right.
On the last day in Vienna, the European Union gave a text. The Iranians took it home and made some changes and said these changes have to be made. When the Iranians gave those changes to Borrell, the UN foreign policy chief, the garden guy.
Yeah, the garden guy.
The garden guy. He said that the Iranian demands were reasonable. At that point, we thought we had a deal. We thought it was finished. Because the issue of the IAEA would have been easily resolved.
Yeah.
If the Americans accept that, the IAEA, I don't want to go into it, it would have been resolved.
Right.
Because the IAEA is a political body. The Board of Governors, their government representatives, it's dominated by the West. The head of the IAEA is in the American camp. The previous head, we have WikiLeaks documents saying that if you choose me, if you support me, I'll be with you on all the main issues. So if the Americans wanted a deal, then the IAEA issue would have been resolved. There's just like in 2015. But then what happened was that the Americans delayed their response, and then ultimately when they gave the response, it was very different from what we expected.
Yeah.
And it was obviously a delaying tactic. And the belief in Tehran was that it was because they were 3 months away from the midterm elections and they got cold feet. Biden and his crew got cold feet.
Quite possible.
So right now we're just waiting. The Americans right now saying we're not going to talk because of the riots and everything and everything else, but the Iranians will wait. Iran right now is selling all of its oil. There's no extra oil. It's selling its gas to Iraq and Turkey. Its trade relations with regional countries and Asian countries are increasing. Russia, now that it's sanctioned, it's cooperating with Iran very extensively, because since now both sides are sanctioned, no one cares about sanctions.
Right.
Inflation in Iran will improve gradually. People in Iran aren't seeing it yet, but the environment for change, Central Asia, Iran's expanding relations with its neighboring countries, it's going to show, but it will take some time.
Yeah.
So if the Americans want a deal, the Iranians are prepared for a deal. But the Europeans and the Americans, if they don't have the will for a deal, Iran will not accept a deal where they can be betrayed again, like right. they were betrayed after 2015. They have to make sure that the deal is adequately protected. If the Americans are willing to accept that, we have a deal. If they're unwilling, then I think it's only going to make suffering in Europe this winter and the next winter and the winter after that more difficult.
Yeah. Well, Professor Morandi, I once again want to thank you for joining me. I always enjoy our discussions and I always learn a lot. And I appreciate you breaking all of this down for our listeners and viewers. Thank you so much. And hopefully we can do this again soon.
Thank you very much for having me. And I learned a lot from your show and from the very good work that you do, both from Beirut and wherever else